This extract takes place fairly near the beginning of the book. My brother Robin has just called me from England to say that my father has died suddenly. I was living in Berlin at the time, in West Berlin. I have one night with my girlfriend Hannah before I fly back to England. This is me getting on the plane. I've brought a book with me but can't take in any of the words. My father's dead, I keep saying to myself. My father's dead. I glance at my fellow passengers. They're behaving as if it's a day like any other. I put the book back in my bag and take out Dad's last letter, dated 30th of January. I'm still feeling short of breath, which isn't very pleasant. However, I must just put up with it. That sentence now seems like a cry for help, and once again I'm surprised at myself for not having reacted. As a rule, Dad would send me a letter every fortnight, and I remember wondering halfway through February why he hadn't written. But I let another week go by. Still, I didn't ring. I suppose I must have been trying to save money. As I slide the letter back into its envelope, I notice that half my address is missing. Dad wrote the name of the street, but forgot to include the house number, and he omitted the postcode entirely. With hindsight, it's a miracle the letter arrived at all. The inaccuracy of the address and his reference to being short of breath suggest that he was in distress. How is it that I didn't realize? I turn to my window and its expanse of pure blue sky. Far below, the North Sea wrinkles, a ship pinned to the surface like a brooch. My father's dead. All of a sudden, I feel unbelievably light and free. My body floods with a secret exhilaration. I could be a spy. I could be famous. I could be on my way to meet someone I'm in love with. Once I've collected my suitcase and my typewriter, I hurry through customs and take an escalator down to the station. My train isn't due for 15 minutes. I've set my luggage down and stroll out along the platform. Though clammy, the air smells burnt, metallic, as if some electrical device has shorted out. I gaze across the fields. Recent heavy rain has flattened the stands of bracken in the nearby railway cut, and there's the constant, distant sound of water trickling. England. Walking back, I notice a tall, burly man staring at me. His Macintosh is beige, like a detective's, its belt fastened tightly, almost chastely, round his midriff, but his hat, a dark brown Homburg with a creamy satin band, looks as if it might belong to a jazz musician. As I approach, he gestures at my suitcase, then says in an American accent, "I was beginning to think there was a bomb in there." "You can't be too careful these days," I say. We look at each other, and even though we're referring to recent terrorist attacks, only 2 months have passed since Harrods was targeted by the IRA, we both laugh quietly. The train arrives. Still standing 20 feet apart, we smile and shrug, then enter different carriages. Once I've found a seat, I gaze out of the window at stations whose names I know by heart. Haywards Heath, Three Bridges, Wivelsfield. After my mother died, Dad sent me away to boarding school, and this was the railway line I would use. I was never in any doubt about what waited for me at the other end. 12 weeks of noise, cold, and hunger. And then there were the horrors that couldn't be predicted, or even imagined. When I was 14, Robin started at the same school, and we would travel together. By then, I no longer dreaded term time, but Robin would sit across from me, his face so pale that all his freckles showed, his left eye twitching. I'd do my best to reassure him. "It'll be all right," I say. "I'll be there, remember?" But I wouldn't. Not after lights out or when the masters weren't around. Not when it mattered most. In his first year, we would meet on Sundays after chapel. Our walks would take us beyond the school's ring fence and into the surrounding woods and fields. I was no longer impatient with him as I'd been when we were young. I didn't mind if he dawdled. There was nowhere we were trying to get to. Sometimes he would tell me what was troubling him, but mostly he kept quiet. It was enough to have the company, a familiar face, an hour or two when he could feel safe. At least, that was how it seemed to me. From Eastbourne Station I take a taxi, and in no time at all we're turning into Somerdown Road. We pull up outside the house. Half hidden by the yew trees in the front garden, it has a withdrawn or injured look, like a person wearing an eye patch. The wooden fence is badly warped, its grey boards on the point of collapsing outwards onto the pavement, and there are cracks and kinks in the tarmac surface of the drive. The windows are blank. It's been dark for hours, but Robin hasn't thought to draw the curtains. Though my father has just died, what the house reminds me of, as always, is the absence of my mother, and as I step out of the taxi, it occurs to me that I might never be able to feel that desolation in its entirety. It's as if my grief is a jigsaw, and I can only deal with it one piece at a time. After paying the driver, I watch as his taillights vanish down the hill. I think about my last visit in November, and how my father locked me out. I remember watching through the letterbox as he fumbled his way downstairs. "All the years go by," he'd said, "but you never forget the sound of your child calling you." I could call him now, and there would be no answer. I could keep on calling. He would not appear. He will never hear my voice again. Fingers pick my heart up like a pack of cards and shuffle it. I walk to the front door and put my luggage down. Then I reach out for the knocker.